Hello, welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. If you haven't already, consider joining Turkey Book Talk as a member to support the podcast. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 60 conversations. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. The archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman History books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman History series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past and there'll be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more people join, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. So to become a Turkey Book Talk member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we publish new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's crack on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome John McManus. He's an anthropologist and postdoctoral fellow at the British Institute in Ankara, and he's also the author of the excellent new book, Welcome to Hell, In Search of the Real Turkish Football, which is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. The book sees John McManus travelling the length and breadth of Turkey, taking us on a journey through the beautiful and less beautiful aspects of the beautiful game, using football as a window through which to examine society, modern history, and contemporary politics in the country. By coincidence, both John and I are originally from Leicestershire, and we're both lifelong fans of Leicester City. Unfortunately, in this conversation, we miss the opportunity to reference English-Turkish club legend Muzzy Izzet, though a couple of pages are devoted to him in John's book, which I think justifies the cover price alone. In this conversation, we discuss all kinds of things, from the culture of the big three clubs, Galatasaray, Fenerbahce and Beşiktaş, to the image of Turkish football abroad, from women's football in the country to fan violence, and from President Erdogan's famous pass with the game to the rise of pro-government Istanbul club Başakşehir. But I started by asking John McManus about how he was introduced to Turkish football in the first place.
Sure. Well, I first came to Turkey 10 years ago in 2008. I didn't actually choose Turkey. Turkey chose me, as in I applied to a European Union scheme to be a English teacher in high schools. And Turkey was actually my third choice. And I was paired with a school in Ankara. So having never visited Turkey before, knowing nothing really about the place, on a cold February night, I flew into Ankara. I got the bus to the bus station where I was picked up by the very friendly English teachers who drove me to the school and walked me into the dormitory. And then I was just hit by this like huge wall of noise, which was basically 100 teenage boys chanting and cheering, which I kind of didn't expect in my slightly sleep deprived state. And anyway, they all kind of jostled me and greeted me and led me through to the bedroom where I was going to be staying. And kind of, I remember someone putting putting something around my neck. But it was all very, there was a lot going on and I couldn't really pay attention to anything whatsoever. And then eventually, you know, I was exhausted. And after like an hour or two, eventually people just like left and I got ready to go to sleep. And then I suddenly paused and realized that I had something around my neck and realized that it was a Galatasaray scar. So that's quite a long-winded anecdote. But basically, the point I'm trying to show from that is that right as soon as I touched down in Turkey, football was part of my life in the school. And then over like the months ahead, I kind of realized that not only were the boys in the school very obsessed with football, but also outside of the school, wider in Turkey, that football really had a role in the society and culture of the country, that I, coming from the UK, which is also a big footballing place, but was even far beyond what I was used to. And at that time, I wasn't an academic. I was just, I'd finished university and kind of wanted an adventure. But it just planted a seed of this is interesting. Yeah, over the course of 10 years, that seed has kind of produced a tree, if it's not extending the metaphor too far. And yeah, the tree of football, shall we say.
Fantastic.
Perhaps maybe one to be cut. Yes, anyway.
No, not at all. That one's staying in. That's going to be the headline, I think. It's funny, actually. I think we came to Turkey around the same time and in similar circumstances. But it's fair to say that you've dug into the subject, obviously, of football in Turkey much more deeply. I mean, personally, I've only really looked at it on the surface, been to a few games, but not really deeply engaged in it. Presumably, you had an impression of Turkish football from afar before you arrived. I wonder if you could just kind of reflect a bit on that aspect. You know, what were you expecting, and how, as you engaged more closely in the game in Turkey, how did it meet those expectations or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably before I arrived in Turkey, my view of Turkish football was quite similar to the view of a lot of people in Britain, which is coloured by one incident in particular, or two incidents. In 1993, when Manchester United visited, they were greeted by banners at the airport, which declared, "Welcome to hell." And over the course of the next 24 hours, the Manchester United team and its fans were subjected to a very, shall we say, raucous and boisterous kind of occasion. There were the players' bus was stoned, the away fans were kind of corralled in a hotel and then deported. The team itself went on to draw 0-0 with Galatasaray and therefore went out of the Champions League. This game on both the Turkish side and the English side has become a very formative moment in both countries' footballing histories. On the Turkish side, it's obviously a huge moment of pride because Galatasaray, definitely the underdog, beat Manchester United, one of Europe's, you know, premier clubs. And on the English side, it generated this idea of Turkey as a place of kind of like unfairness and, you know, possibly violent place. And then 7 years later, in the year 2000, that image was unfortunately given greater weight when two Leeds fans were stabbed to death by Galatasaray supporters in Taksim Squares. Now, that is kind of cemented the link in many people's minds in the UK that is Turkish football. And the book, my experience from kind of 2008, 2009 onwards was completely, was on the other side of the spectrum. So it's almost as if we're talking about two separate objects here. You know, there's this image of the game in the UK, you know, being very violent and filled with death and unfairness. And then I was just witnessing like the most incredible like joviality and camaraderie. And then when I started to research Turkish football fans, like I realized a huge wealth of like, you know, biting humor, politics even, and a huge kind of depth to fandom, which people in the UK didn't recognize or didn't want to see. So really, that's the starting point of the book. And that's why the book has the title that it has. If you're not a football fan, it might seem a little bit odd or perhaps melodramatic, but it's because the jumping off point for an outsider to Turkey is this image, because unfortunately, this negative image still predominates in the UK and probably more widely of football in Turkey is solely about the violence. And my goal in writing the book is to show definitively that that's not the case. Now, I should say that in the process of doing the research, I realized that there are dark elements to football in Turkey, and it's important to talk about them, as I do in the book. And I actually finish on a slightly more ambivalent note. But the point is that there needed to be a correction of the image of football fans in Turkey abroad. Hopefully this book will help to do that.
Yeah, I did get that sense reading the book. It's almost, you don't put it in these terms, but it's almost the kind of journey from innocence to experience, because you start out with this idea that you want to kind of narrate the story of Turkish football in kind of multicoloured, you know, show a different side to what the stereotype is. But at the same time, all these stories that you, as you dig a bit deeper, you know, that you talk about cynicism and anger that that you experienced, and coming to appreciate the kind of darkness and unsavouriness pushing at the seams. And that really does come through. I think it's a very effective part of the book, you know, the way that you kind of describe this this unfolding experience. And of course, that also may have something to do with probably the course of the country, really, because over the years, you know, things have kind of deteriorated in recent years for obvious reasons. And you talk about this sense of feeling that the country is kind of sliding down the rabbit hole, and particularly after the coup attempt, like it's reached the kind of point of total meltdown since 2016. And you get the sense in the book that football has not been an escape or a distraction from this kind of process.
Right, exactly. I think it's quite interesting you say that, because my personal arc is tied up very much in the arc of the country itself. I mean, I came in 2008, which was in many ways the height of the AKP in some way, and their project of, well, they'd been in power for 6 years, and the economy was going well. You know, Turkey was being mentioned abroad as a model for the region, foreign investment was flooding in, and the country was really buoyed with a sense of optimism, I think. You know, a lot of those points are not the same today, 10 years later. It's quite interesting as well, because also the book is about going through the different levels of coming to know a place. Because I turned up in Turkey and I didn't speak a word of Turkish. And if you go to a football match and you don't speak a word of Turkish, then your impressions are one thing. But as you start to learn a language, then you start to be able to look at it in a different level. And in some ways, that helps to understand the richness of the footballing culture, that, you know, like you start to understand the lyrics when it's songs like, you know, like if you forgive me, it's like gücüne güç katmaya geldik formaya te ölmeye geldik Beşiktaş seninle ölmeye geldik Beşiktaş. Which, when I first heard it, was just like, ah, that's quite a nice ditty that just kind of bounces along. But then you actually, like, when you start to learn the words, you know, it's like, we came to, like, add strength to your strength. We came to be the sweat on your shirt. Beşiktaş, we came to die for you. It suddenly takes on quite a different meaning. You realize a bit like the humor in this song, in a way, you know, this kind of melodrama. And that's a way of kind of understanding that, you know, you're really pulled into Turkey. And for me, that really helped to generate a sense of grounding and belonging, actually. And then finally, but you sort of pass through and you get all that, and then you start to pick up on some of the more negative aspects, or the, you know, the slighter sides, or, you know, the more you become ingrained, the more you start to pick up. You know, I don't know if this is also true for, like, your general experience in Turkey as well, given, you know, you've been coming and going for about the same length of time. You know, you start to realize some of the aspects which you maybe turned a blind eye to at first, or in light of your kind of beginner's enthusiasm. So yeah, but it's hard to kind of separate those things out, the wider politics, from my own experience. And so I decided to kind of write about it together, because I feel that that is the most honest way of approaching it.
Now, the book is divided into 16 chapters, basically kind of examining a different aspect of Turkish football, how it intersects with history, society, politics. And you cross the entire country really throughout the book, meeting various unique characters and listening to their stories. And I just want to kind of zone in on a few of the issues and the individuals that you look at in the book. And first of all, I think a good place to start is really to kind of reflect a bit on two very prominent characters in modern Turkish football, really, for better or for worse. The player Arda Turan, who's just signed for Başakşehir here from Barcelona, plays for the Turkish national team sometimes, and also the manager Fatih Terim, this legendary character who's currently managing Galatasaray and does also manage the Turkish national team. And in your book, you give these kind of mini biographies of these two characters. I wonder if you could just kind of describe for us why these two characters, Arda Turan and Fatih Terim, why they're significant and what they can teach us about Turkish football today.
Sure, yeah. I think I'd start with Fatih Terim. He is arguably the most famous figure in Turkish football currently. He's, you know, in his 60s now, but has been a feature of the Turkish footballing landscape since the 70s, really, when he was a player at Galatasaray. But in many ways, Terim is a kind of chalk or cheese kind of man, as in opinions on him divide the country often, or divide settings, divide parties, divide rooms. It just seems he's a figure where lots of people either kind of love or hate him. It's quite hard to find a middle ground. And I found that quite interesting because that, for me, reflects symptomatic of a wider situation in Turkey at the moment, which is that a middle ground on people is quite difficult to hold often. You have to, you know, be a supporter or you're there or you're not. I found his character, I just really didn't know very much about him before I started researching it and looked into it. In the process, I tried to paint in a bit of a middle ground between the pictures. I don't know if some readers will appreciate that. But I mean, his story is a classic rags to riches in terms of a poor boy from Adana who managed to rise to become the most successful Turkish manager of all time, the only manager to have won a European trophy with a Turkish team, the UEFA Cup with Galatasaray in 2000. But many people disagree with what he's seen as representing a kind of like macho image of kind of the Turkish male. And the purpose of the chapter was to explore that, you know, is that fair? And to what extent is it? And I would say there's obviously a degree of truth in it. But also, I do think that he's potentially a more complex character than some people give credence to. You know, I think he's intelligent, you know, perhaps not articulate, but I don't think you can get to where he is without having a certain degree of intelligence. I also don't think, whilst in certain ways he seems very macho and boisterous, he was sacked from the Turkish football team last year after driving 400 kilometres with like his son-in-law and a bodyguard to go and like attack a restaurant owner who had apparently slighted his family. So it's pretty alpha male territory. But at the same time, in some of his other pronouncements, he's not necessarily 100% in that role. What I find quite interesting is I feel as if as an outsider, I have a bit more latitude to ponder this question. I sometimes found I've angered a lot of Turkish people when I've spoken about him, because they again find him just like really, really do not like this man, and any attempt at trying to think about him in the round or in a different way is tantamount to condoning his behavior, which I should say I don't. But I just find it interesting to, you know, how much do these figures stand as, for like it or not, these people do represent Turkey on an international stage, and it's interesting to see what comes with that and to explore those kind of fashions. In terms of Arda is one of the most successful Turkish footballers of all time, probably, and certainly of the current era. You know, he was came from a poor, not poor really, but working class background in Bayrampaşa in Istanbul. Istanbul and quickly rose to become one of Turkey's most talented and successful footballers, earning a transfer to Spain in 2011, I think, if I'm not mistaken, where he kind of like, enhanced his reputation by doing very well at Atletico Madrid and then moved to obviously Barcelona, which was in many eyes the largest, most important club in the world. But then things started to go a bit wrong. And within sort of 18 months, he's now at Başakşehir back in Turkey. And again, Arda is, I don't know, it's too simplistic to see him as like a, you know, the next generation's Fatih Terim, because he's quite a different man. And also 30 years makes a big difference in terms of like social and cultural behaviors, both in terms of like masculinity, but also just in general, Turkey's place in the world. But he is it like Fatih Terim in terms of his becoming like a point about around which debates cluster and kind of and a polarizing figure, I should say. There are lots of people who really do not like Arda for sometimes quite good reasons. He has also had like a bust up with a journalist on a plane and has also made some political statements in support of the government, both of which has not endeared him to certain segments of the population. And so I don't know, but again, there's perhaps more going on under the surface than sometimes people realize. I actually bumped into his dad when I went to look at his street. The street on which he grew up is now changed and named after him. I went to have a look and bumped into his dad, who, speaking to him, I got a slightly different impression of Arda. I don't know, I'd sort of looking at his time in Spain, reading some of the, you know, biography was written of him by a Spanish writer when he was in Spain. It was very interesting. He has a very different image in Spain, as almost a hipster and a sort of cosmopolite, whereas in Turkey he's kind of like this slemmy, unreconstructed maganga kind of figure. And perhaps the truth is neither of those, but perhaps somewhere in the middle, or I don't know. I find it interesting to, when thinking about lots of broader issues to do with Turkey and its place in the world, I think it's quite interesting sometimes to look at these public figures who in some ways have become metonyms, or at least kind of points around which these larger social and cultural forces kind of cluster. I don't know, that's why I presented their two portraits, because I'm hoping that the complexity and the detail will help to nuance some of those debates going on in Turkey and to nuance some of the understand how football fits into them.
You allude to it there. I think one of the reasons why Arda Turan and Fatih Terim are these kind of polarizing figures is because they're quite close to the biggest man of all, President Erdogan. And of course, Erdogan himself has got his own history with football, very well known. You know, he likes the game, and when he was younger, he played, I think, at a semi-professional level up until his 20s, really. People have these kind of legends about Erdogan playing football and how good he was or not, you know, and there's a lot of myth-making going on. Nobody really knows the truth, but what if you could kind of dig in a little bit to this question? You know, what did you learn as you did the research about Erdogan's background with football, and what does it tell us about his persona as well?
It's actually often quite difficult, not just on this topic, but on topics in general, to get to a definitive answer. I mean, football clubs are the same with like the histories of Galatasaray, Besiktas and Fenerbahce, these big clubs that mean so much to people, that the details or the historical details are often lost amidst the stories that are told about them. And as an anthropologist, for me, that doesn't generate frustration. I actually find that more interesting in a way, that I'm not so driven by trying to find out the objective details as to what, asking like, why have these stories grown up, or why is there kind of confusion or clashes over these narratives. So anyway, on turning to president, it's very interesting to see that like in other realms, there are books written which extol his playing career and his role in that, and then there are other books which sort of try and trash it, or to say that it's all made up. And it's again quite hard to pass where the truth lies, so I've essentially just tried to present in the book both sides, really, and to see the stories that come up around them. I think that football was definitely an important part of his life, and it's interesting how football is pulled in to building a image of oneself. This happens on the daily level with millions of men across Turkey who have their Beşiktaş logo on the car, you know, watch the TV or play in their like Halisahar match on a Saturday evening. And football is a part of how they build their lives as men. And therefore, you know, as a trying to be a man above other men, as in, you know, trying to be a leader of men, then football becomes a tool, really, or it's helpful to exemplify your involvement in the game and to emphasize certain elements. And I think that Erdogan has done that very well, or not necessarily himself, but people around him have done that to help kind of bolster that image. And I think it's an important plank of his persona as a leader nowadays. I think this sense of a connection to a certain virile masculinity.
Yeah. Did he play at Kasımpaşa? Is that right? Because obviously he grew up there, but...
No, I don't think he did. I don't know. I don't think he did. I mean, the biggest issue is that he was his close brush with Fenerbahçe, where apparently he was considered or went for a trial, or depending on who you speak to, but nothing ever came about it because the coach, the Serbian coach at the time, moved on. You know, some people deride this and say, like, as if Fenerbahçe would be sniffing around semi-amateur players and teams. But it was the 1970s. And at the same time, definitively, another player who he played against, who actually accidentally or maybe purposefully elbowed Erdogan in the face, to the result that he still has a scar nowadays, which he calls like his footballing memento. That player in question went on to play for the Turkish national side only briefly. But, you know, if a player who he's playing against went on to do that, then it's not, you know, completely fantastical that he could have been on their radar. But I think, as with many questions in Turkey, I'm not sure you'll ever get a definitive answer. Well, unfortunately, I never got the chance to ask him in person.
If only. I love Kasımpaşa, actually. They've got the best stadium because it's there, right there in the very accessible in Beyoğlu, basically, very close to Taksim. And their stadium is called the Recep Tayyip Erdoğan Stadium. And the tickets are very cheap, so it's very nice little atmosphere down there.
Are you a regular frequenter?
I've been a couple of times. It's not, you go to, like, you mentioned in the book, you go to Galatasaray and this new stadium that they've built out of town, it's very difficult to get to and it's kind of alienating. I prefer these kind of neighbourhood teams. The Beşiktaş ground is good for that as well, I think. You know, it's right there, nestled in the neighbourhood of Beşiktaş, really.
This is kind of an important point, actually, that we've kind of strayed onto, which is the huge changes in wealth in Turkish football and their knock-on effects for the fan experience. I sometimes feel that Turkey is a little bit like a time machine, and it's been going over the 10 years in which I've been looking at football. It's been going through a lot of the changes which took place in England when I was a sort of child and teenager. That is the rapid commercialization, followed by the building of new facilities and a concomitant difference in the spectator experience, for want of a better term, like smoothing its rough edges. Now, you can take the comparison too far. There are important differences, especially Turkey's system for going to matches since 2014. This requires you to have like a sort of supporters ID card. That's a step beyond the UK, but not Western Europe in general. There are other countries that have similar systems. Holland, for instance. Italy has another slightly different system. I don't know. Sometimes when we look at a country, it's quite easy to chop it off from the surrounding world and to kind of highlight it to the extent that it becomes exceptional. But you know, Turkey, you know, is not immune from these wider flows. Football is one of the biggest kind of global cultural phenomenon, and its growth is linked to that. You know, how many of the starting Galatasaray 11 are Turkish? The answer is, I think, maybe two or three. So football in Turkey is very international and in some ways cosmopolitan.
You alluded to it there, the ticketing system that changed a few seasons ago. It's called the Paso League system, and it was very controversial when it was first brought in. Particularly, again, it was politicized from the beginning, really, because it was basically seen as this kind of pro-government money-making scheme. And there was all kinds of justifications for bringing in this system, but nobody really liked it. And the attendances at games in the season it was introduced and the seasons afterwards fell off quite a lot, and they've still were not really recovered, as far as I understand. Could you just kind of introduce this issue, like just explain what it was all about and what have been the ongoing effects of the Pasa leak system?
Well, it's quite a deep and complicated issue. Essentially, Turkey, like many countries, violence is not unheard of amongst football fans, both with rival fans, but also with the police, sometimes even within the fan groups themselves. Coming from the UK, like violence in football essentially defined the game in the 1980s, leading to some quite high profile incidents where fans were killed and English teams were banned from European competition for 5 years. As a punishment, really. And there have been kind of flashes of that in Turkey over the decades, especially in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And in order to try and mitigate this or prevent it, the Turkish Football Federation, you know, did a lot of research at policing methods and laws in other countries and then came up with their own version for Turkey. And this Pasa League, actually, ID system where you need to sign up for an ID card in order to buy a ticket in order to go. This is actually only one element of a wider law. It's known by its code in the statute, the 6222 law. I think the full title is for law and prevention of violence in football. And so that lots basically just handed a lot more authority to police and stadium officials in order to control fans. It involved having to install much better security systems in the stadium to monitor fans and increase the punishments that could be doled out for bad behavior in an attempt to control the violence. Now, because of the tendering system for the Pasa League card, went to a bank which has links to Berat Albayrak, the son-in-law of President Erdogan. Many people see this as another example of favors for pro-government business, and also they wonder if the scheme in itself is not a glorified attempt to recruit customers for a bank. So almost like a big marketing scheme in a way. Again, it's hard to know without being able to ask the people themselves. There's an academic called Yarmo Nurat at Bilgi University who researched extensively kind of the introduction of this law of football around the time this law was introduced. And the process, it was started before Gezi Park, the process of researching this law and planning to introduce it. But then it was introduced post Gezi Park. So in terms of the public consciousness, it was seen by many as like a sort of knee-jerk reaction to that on behalf of the government to this obviously mass protest, which it, you know, didn't like. But it's slightly more complicated. I'm by no means a fan of the Pasa League system or 6222. I think it's a very crude mechanism which hasn't actually solved any problems, as like the witnessed just last week. There's a high profile incident involving the Besiktas manager having his head split open by someone throwing something at him from the terraces. So I'm not a huge fan of the law, but it's also at the same time, sometimes the criticisms of it, A, don't realize that people are trying to do something, or, you know, then, and B, that I don't know, that there is, the time frame is wider. It's a larger issue going on here with who controls the space of the stadium, who should be allowed to go, what kind of profile do we want of fans. And again, like I said, I think fits in with a wider gentrification of football across Europe. Match going fans are trying to middle classify that process, which at the big three, Besiktas, Galatasaray and Fenerbahce, is well underway, as anybody who's been to one of their matches recently will witness. I mean, stadiums are very nice and the fan profile is certainly richer than when I started going 10 years ago.
Now, football in Turkey is obviously a very masculine area, but in one of the chapters you go in search of women's football in Turkey. It's really a very small section. It's not got really any public profile at all, to be honest, especially in comparison with some other countries. It's obviously not the first thing that will spring to mind when people think of football in Turkey, but it was a very interesting chapter. I just wonder if you could kind of share, you know, what did you learn as you wrote this chapter?
Well, first off, a good 20% of match-going fans are female, which frequently kind of gets left out of most treatments of football in Turkey, including sometimes my own. But I think that it's very interesting to see how football is generated as a man's space. Turkey isn't alone in this. Kind of football is predominantly male in pretty much every country apart from perhaps the United States. But perhaps it is a bit more excessively policed or pushed that way in Turkey. When you talk about the chants, there's a Beşiktaş chant, for instance, that says, like, our district is the man's district. Let no one be left out of the shadow of the flag. And, well, by calling it the man's district already, you're denying, you know, 50% of the population that chance to buy into the fandom in the same way. So I kind of started off by looking at why it is that women perhaps are marginalized or forced into kind of adopting discourses which are essentially male behavior patterns in order to fit in or to prove their belonging. But then it's interesting going through to the other end of the spectrum and looking at actually those who play football as well. And unfortunately, football is codified as a man's game in Turkey, as I said, it is in many countries. And therefore, there's a lot of suspicion, or maybe not suspicion, but just resistance to women playing or girls playing. And I spent some time with some of the people who are trying to counteract this resistance, you know, youth team coaches, people at the Turkish Football Federation, people just in local neighborhoods who see that a lot of girls want to play football, which is not surprising, really, when football is on television from morning till night and spoken about in all the streets and at the bus stops. You know, it's not surprising that women would want to be as involved in it. And I just explored kind of why it is, what are some of the factors that prevent that, and what are some of the people doing to try and lift that. As you pointed out, it's quite small in comparison, but I was quite heartened by some of the incredible stories of women players who have struggled against, you know, a lot of prejudice, and how they themselves are increasing in number, becoming PE teachers, and then having an effect on the ones that they teach. And it's definitely moving in the right direction. 10 years ago, there were a handful of women's teams, and now there are over something like 130 across Turkey in every single province. So whilst it needs far more attention and exposure and money, the trend is perhaps in the right direction.
And you also, in one of the chapters, that you go to Diyarbakir. Really, this is football at its most politicized. It's a club in the Kurdish-majority southeast, which has changed its name to the Kurdish language Ahmetspor from Diyarbakirspor. And football's got a very kind of interesting past few decades in Diyarbakir anyway, with various different clubs. You actually went down there to watch a couple of games right at the time after the peace process had broken down. So it was obviously very tense, and there were clashes everywhere. And as the match was going on, you saw people getting tear gassed and whatnot. Just talk a bit about Diyarbakirspor or Ahmetspor.
Yes. I mean, it's very confusing. It's actually Diyarbakir Belediyespor or something, which became Ahmetspor, who became like a lightning rod for the larger tensions surrounding the peace process, or the failed peace process, and the war against Kurdish militants. Much to the chagrin of the football team themselves, who frequently would say, "We're a football team of Turkey and should want to be treated as such." It's a very complicated topic, really, in terms of how football has become entwined in the larger struggle over the issue in the southeast. I mean, in some ways, football should be a realm in which many people view football as a realm in which daily life can be put on hold, and our belongings and attachments shouldn't figure. We should just go and cheer or do, depending on whether we're playing or watching. And it's just quite interesting to, perhaps it's more politicized than ever surrounding this, the naming of this football team, and both choosing to name the side, knowing that there will be a reaction from more nationalistic people, and then which duly happens, which then duly makes people upset, which duly leads to certain punishments, which in some ways it's quite exhausting, really, to and I found it quite one of the most upsetting elements elements of the research was to look at just how even this game, which many people want to have as their bit of light relief or their bit on the side, has become this extremely politicized device or this politicized arena. But then there are obviously some who really like that. There are some who see that as very important on both the Kurdish and Turkish sides. You know, should this side be a, you know, symbol of Diyarbakir's pride and Kurdish pride more generally, or is it the Turkish side? Or, I mean, this is an issue which is still being played out today. And I mean, Ahmedspor in the third tier of the leagues, and it's a question which I don't think is going to go away anytime soon.
And one of the other major politicized clubs, let's say, these days is Başakşehir. And it's not actually included in the book, I think, I presume, due to publishing deadlines. But it's become this story, particularly this season, because they're basically this minnow club, really, in Istanbul, formed out of the old municipality club. It's basically come out of nowhere, and it's been this kind of lab rat that the government's kind of pumped a load of money into. And it's now challenging for the Turkish Super League title, really mixing up with the big three, Galatasaray, Fenerbahce and Beşiktaş, and it's really put a lot of noses out of joint, and it's a very interesting story, really. Could you just talk a bit about this Başakşehir phenomenon over the last few seasons? Where did it come from, and where's it going?
Yeah, well, you rightly said that it's the Achilles heel of the book, that this is not really addressed directly, although it is spoken about as part of the wider changes of the AKP era. Essentially, Başakşehir came into existence in 2014 when the Istanbul Municipality Club was sold to like a private consortium of business owners, many of whom are seen as AKP supporters. Certainly the president of the site, Göksal Gümüşdağ, is, as he is also related by marriage to Emine Erdoğan, the wife of the president. So it's some fans of the club vehemently protest that they are quote unquote a government team. Yet it's certainly true that they have links, you know, or at least sympathies with the government. And yeah, but the interesting thing about them is that they also have quite a good football team. So their coach is Abdullah Avcı, who managed the national side back in the early 2000s and is a pretty savvy coach, no one's fool. And they also have a swathe of pretty decent players, some of whom are kind of foreign exports coming to the ends of their careers. I think of like Gael Clichy and Emmanuel Adebayor, both of whom played most of their career in the Premier League in England, and then also some good Turkish talent or fading Turkish talent. You've got Volkan Babacan, the goalkeeper. You had Cengiz Ünder, who has transferred to Roma, and you have Emre Belözoğlu, who again, like Arda Turan, really divides opinion, or mostly just people don't like him, but who even in his mid-30s is still not a bad footballer. They've played quite captivating football. So on the one hand, what the club represents, especially for, you know, many people who love the history and the culture of the big three, is quite an unseemly, arrivist attempt at, you know, muscling in. And especially for those who are not fans of the government, this is seen very distastefully. But I mean, actually on the pitch itself, on the football, it's a bit less clear cut. But it's interesting. I mean, in a way, the club shows, even though the club is doing quite well on the pitch, it doesn't have very many fans. It struggles to fill its stadium. And if they do win the league, I live in Ankara, and last season when Beşiktaş won, the entire city centre came to a standstill as thousands of fans poured onto the street. And this is obviously hundreds of miles away from Beşiktaş's home in Istanbul. If Başakşehir do make the final step and become champions this season, I'd be very surprised if something similar happened.
Yeah, it's possible to play devil's advocate as well, because the big three teams, clubs, have got all this baggage that is quite unpleasant as well in many ways, and they almost sometimes feel like a kind of vehicle really for the egos of the chairman and the managers, and they're hugely bloated. They take up all the energy of Turkish football, and people, as you mentioned there, people across the country support these big three clubs. There's not as much of a local a sense of supporting your local club because of the energy that these big three hoover up, and to see a smaller team coming in. And the other thing that they do is they invest a lot in training facilities and in youth facilities, as far as I'm aware. So in a way, you could argue that the Başakşehir is kind of a more wholesome experience, even though they haven't got any fans, even though they're not really a proper club. When you compare it to some of the more unsavory aspects of the bigger clubs, maybe to play devil's advocate, it would be nice to see them win. I don't even know if I believe what I'm saying here, but you could make that argument.
Well, you could make that argument. I think that perhaps people are worried about how a Başakşehir win would be leveraged by the government or other people. I think that it's perhaps on the level of the 2,000 fans or whatever they have, they will be very happy. But there's also something just a bit sad when you have Beşiktaş, Galatasaray and Fenerbahçe are just these real cultural phenomenons in Turkey, as anybody who has visited will know, or anybody who lives there, obviously. They represent far, far more than simply football clubs. You know, they almost represent worldviews, and in terms of institutions, they're older than the Turkish state itself. So these are really kind of storied, fixed elements of social and cultural life, and you can't really sweep them away easily, or, you know, nor should you be able to in some ways. I think that they provide kind of like grounding and sustenance for many people. And in a country which has gone through, you know, astronomical change in recent years, you know, a child today and their lifestyle, the difference between that and their grandparents, or, you know, and what they've witnessed will be, you know, in many cases, extremely pronounced. And I think that these three clubs provide a kind of like soothing effect or just a orientation. And I don't know, I just think if an Arrivist was to muscle in, it would be a bit sad that, you know, 30% of the population can't go through there, you know, can't have that annual moment of like catharsis and joy which accompanies a win. But then I'm a Beşiktaş fan, so I would say that.
Well, they're still in the running this season, Başakşehir here.
It's very exciting. Four teams are still capable of winning the league. So that's the big three and Başakşehir here. So really, it looks like it's going to go down to the wire. All options are possible. We'll see what happens. But it's part of football's strength or just the complexity of football, is that because it's those three clubs, because they've been around so long, they're not so easily cowed or altered or, you know, able to be moved. So they represent, you know, they themselves are anchors to a certain identity in Turkey. And I think a lot of people who are perhaps unhappy with the current political situation take some solace in that, you know. I think that that's why perhaps this threat is of Başakşehir feels quite existential. It feels like as if in this realm, this realm that they turn to for consistency and solace, you know, when everything else is changing, has also changed. It's like, not only is there big earthquakes in political and social life, but also our bloody football team no longer wins the league.
And Erdogan is a Fenerbahce fan, apparently. So I think people invest like too much political meaning in football club. I remember during Gezi, it was like everybody was thinking, oh, I can't believe they've brought together all the fans of these clubs, as if football fans of all one team have a particular political opinion. It's like people were thinking about Başakşehir, oh, it's a pro-government club, so all the government supporters support Başakşehir here. Like, clearly that's not true. It's easy to kind of read in too much political meaning into the clubs.
No, I think that's a really important point. I think that like football clubs and football in general is not a simple mirror to life or political or economic factors. But yet frequently we turn to it and expect that from it. And there's a bit of a disconnect there where I think that football clubs, they're far more complex than that, because of the like emotion involved by many people in football. They become this kind of like malleable container that you can kind of pour into it what you want, in a way. And yes, for a lot of people, they want to use it to like reinforce a sense of belonging, which often comes by these quite like Manichean divides, you know, like I'm anti-government, so my football club is and that one isn't, you know, or I'm X, so this should also be X and that should be Y. But especially with the big three, where they have tens of millions of fans across the country, there's just too many people from too many walks of life for any of the these kind of like cliched ideas about the football clubs to hold true. For instance, a common refrain that people would tell me when they first met me, if they didn't really know, or that, you know, that people assume you're as an outsider, you don't know very much about football. So they would say, Galatasaray are the team of the aristocracy, Fenerbahce are the team of the middle classes, and Beşiktaş are the halk takımı, the people's team. And I tell you that mostly from Beşiktaş fans, of course, because it paints them in the most romantic light, but also variations on that from fans of other sides. And, you know, it bears no resemblance to the actual reality of modern day Turkey. I mean, perhaps back in the day when Galatasaray is linked, obviously, to the Galatasaray High School, which is a very important old high school, which has educated a lot of elites. And perhaps in the club structure, there might be a element of truth in that. But at the fan level, it's definitively not the case that Galatasaray is a aristocratic club. There are plenty of working class Galatasaray fans. I don't know. Doing this research was a bit like sometimes poking a sleeping dog with a stick, or sometimes people would growl and get a bit nasty because you're treading on people's, like I said before, you're treading on people's dreams, or their refuge in a way, their football club. People who might dispassionately accept contradictory views or suggestions in other realms of life, even at their work or in their family life even. But when it comes to their football club, these narratives that we tell ourselves about why we have that side and what does our side represent, these are really, really, really hardwired into a lot of people, not just in Turkey, across the world. That's why football is what it is, and definitively the most universal cultural practice. People pray the world over, but to different, different religions. But, you know, everybody plays football by the same game. It's the one, you know, it's a real, always a source of amazement for me. And so, which is, again, a reason for, you know, writing this book and thinking about why at this moment in time, for so many billions, do we see, you know, do we pour so much into football and use football as our compass for moving through the world? I can't really answer, but I think the book is a kind of mediation on that question in the Turkish context.
That was John McManus. Many thanks to him. Let me also once again say that his book is very good indeed, so you should read it if you can get your hands on a copy. By coincidence, another new book has just been published about Turkish football. It's written by journalist Patrick Keddie and called Football and the Story of Modern Turkey. I've got my hands on a copy, so hopefully we'll be able to publish an episode on that too in a few months. In the meantime, remember to consider joining the Turkey Book Talk membership system to support the podcast. All you have to do to become a member is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Patreon. Membership gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 60 conversations so far, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. As a member, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites, and many thanks to all current members. It's very much appreciated. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any suggestions, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Save all of you.